first became aware of it, this problem in Alaska, because of anonymous tip-in complaint.
A lead paint violation during the renovation of the governor's mansion. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, March 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, an unusual proposal to preserve fish and fill freezers on the Kuskokwim.
Every single escapement project on the Kuskokwim was the lowest we've ever seen, so we are in pretty much a dire situation.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
March is Brain Injury Awareness Month. Over 800 Alaskans are diagnosed with serious brain injuries each year. 150 will die from their injuries. A variety of activities such as snow machining, riding ATVs, and playing sports carry risks of brain injury or concussion. Prevention, diagnosis, and treatment are important. Safety is a way of life. Think ahead. Protect your brain. Learn more at alaskabraininjury.net. This message brought to you by the Alaska Brain Injury Network.
Throughout his administration, Governor Sean Parnell has accused the Environmental Protection Agency of overreaching on Alaska affairs. Now it looks like the EPA may have reached into Parnell's own home. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that the governor's mansion appears on a list of construction projects requiring EPA intervention for lead violations.
Lead poisoning is nasty business. It can cause headaches and seizures and result in miscarriages. If you're a child, the symptoms are especially bad.
Lethargy, inability to pay attention. At high enough levels, it can cause death.
That's Wallace Reed. He works out of the EPA's Seattle office, and his team handles investigations into lead violations. Because a lot of modern cases of lead exposure are caused by home repairs, the EPA implemented a rule in 2010 requiring contractors to be certified in lead paint removal if they're working on a house that was built before 1978. Like the Alaska Governor's Mansion. The building is a century old, and the state hired Alaska commercial contractors to restore the whole exterior a couple of years ago. And that meant removing lead paint, which the company was not certified to do at the time.
We first became aware of it, this problem in Alaska, because of anonymous tip-in complaint that this work was going on and that there were problems associated with it.
Reed says that as soon as the EPA learned of the violation, they sent two inspectors to check the area for lead paint. They found paint chips on the lawn and on the street.
When we do this kind of work, all of the lead paint chips and dust has to be maintained within a contained area. In this case, it was not. And the company was not certified, and the employees were not trained. So those were fundamental violations of our rule.
Because of the violations, Alaska commercial contractors ended up settling with the EPA for $32,000. Their subcontractor, Vanpool Painting, was also dinged $10,000. While the settlements were finalized in September, the EPA only recently made the violations public. Alaska commercial contractors declined to do a taped interview for this story because there are still outstanding legal questions related to the construction project. But in a written statement, company president Doug Courtney emphasized that Alaska commercial contractors cooperated fully with the EPA and that they became certified in lead paint removal shortly after the incident. So why did the state hire a company that was not certified in lead paint removal in the first place? When asked about that, Administration Commissioner Curtis Thayer declined an interview because of ongoing challenges to the contract. At $1.5 million, Alaska Commercial Contractors was the highest bidder for the project, and rival contractors appealed the award. Governor Sean Parnell also declined repeated requests for an interview. Instead, his office referred questions to Larry Hartig, the Commissioner of Environmental Conservation. Hartig says his department's involvement in the renovation problem was limited. They mostly helped the EPA get access to the governor's home to make sure the lead paint did not pose a health hazard.
Obviously, there was concerns about the safety of the governor's family. And so they were interested in what was going on. We all were in making sure that if there is a issue here that could impact the governor and his family, we wanted to be on top of that.
Hartig says there was no real risk to the Parnell family.
And as far as we know.
He says even the governor's yellow Labrador, the most frequent user of the mansion's backyard, was kept safe from lead exposure. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A former employee of the state crime lab in Anchorage has been charged with 6 felonies, including drug misconduct and tampering with evidence. The Department of Law says 53-year-old Stephen Palmer was arrested today. He's charged with a scheme to defraud, drug misconduct, and 4 counts of evidence tampering. He's also charged with 4 misdemeanor counts of official misconduct. Alaska State Troopers launched an investigation 7 months ago after detecting irregularities in lab reference standards, the controlled samples of illegal drugs kept at the state crime lab. Prosecutors say investigators also determined drug evidence was missing in cases worked by Palmer. Prosecutors say they don't believe the irregularities discovered in reference standards affected the validity of testing performed by other analysts. Borough mayors are asking to be part of the discussions on terms related to a mega liquefied natural gas project that will affect local communities. An agreement signed by the state and companies pursuing the project says, subject to consultation between the state and local governments, payments in lieu of property taxes would be paid by the companies. The mayor of the Kenai Peninsula Borough, Mike Navarre, told the Senate Finance Committee that consultation is not a strong word. The mayors are seeking greater assurances for the level of input they will have as the process moves forward. The committee is weighing a bill that would make the state an equity partner and allow for the project to move into a phase of preliminary engineering and design. Jeff King is resting at the Yukon River checkpoint of Ruby. The 4-time Iditarod champion is technically in the lead at this point, but Martin Boozer, Ali Zirkel, and Robert Sorley are closing in, and they've already completed their 24-hour layovers. Once teams leave Ruby, they'll have a chance to take advantage of any remaining speed they have on the flat river miles ahead. KYC's Emily Schwing is in Ruby and joins me now. Hi, Emily.
Hi, Lori.
Emily, is there any way to know who is actually in the lead at this point in the race?
Well, Lori, we'll know more once teams start to travel down the Yukon River, and by the time they get into Caltag, we'll definitely know a little bit more about how this race could shake out at the front. For now, I think Martin Boozer has a little bit of a lead, but he also has most of his rest early on in the race, and he's still pushing his dogs. So it could be that he could lose some of that lead as these teams that are resting here in Ruby and those that have also rested for 24 in Ophir and Takotna catch up with him.
How might the race change as teams start running down the Yukon?
Well, the Yukon River is flat and there's about 130 miles of smooth trail. So teams with a lot of speed might have an advantage there. So, for example, Robert Sorley really likes to run his team at a high speed and then rest for a longer time than other mushers, whereas Jeff King's team is comprised of bigger dogs and they're a little bit more powerful. So Sorley's team might have the advantage on the river.
How about the trail out of Ruby? How is that looking?
The trail out of Ruby looks great. It's a beautiful day. Temperatures are below zero, which is optimal for thick-coated sled dogs. However, the wind has picked up today, and there are reports trickling out of Galena that the trail has drifted over in spots. And some of that wind-blown snow will get transformed into a more sugary snow. That's hard on dog paws, and it could slow teams down a little bit.
Emily, what other dynamics are at play at this point in the race?
Well, mushers have to take an 8-hour mandatory rest somewhere along the Yukon River. So that includes checkpoints here in Ruby, as well as Galena, Nalato, and then in Caltag, where they come off the river. So they may choose to take a mandatory rest here in Ruby after having run 73 miles from Cripple. That's one of the longest runs on the trail. They could also decide to run the trail between Ruby, Galena, and Nalato in one shot and then rest there. They may also decide that Caltag is the best place to take an 8-hour rest because that run from Caltag to Unalakleet, it's 85 miles, and that is the longest run on the Iditarod Trail.
All right, Emily, thanks so much for that trail update.
Sure thing, Lori. Thanks a lot.
KUAC's Emily Schwing is reporting on the Iditarod for APRN. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a biker finishes the Iditarod Trail at the pace of a decent sled dog team.
You're just riding and eating and sleeping, and that's it. And it's got a very nice rhythm, and it's fun, and you're out in incredible scenery.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
The United States and four other Arctic nations have tentatively agreed to prevent commercial fishing in the high Arctic. The Canadian Press reports that Canada, Denmark, Norway, and Russia signed on to the ban after 3 days of meetings in Greenland last week. The measure was originally pitched by the United States, and it didn't have support from Norway or Russia until now. The details of the ban are still being worked out, but the basics are clear. The countries have to do more scientific research on Arctic fish stocks. In the meantime, they will not engage in commercial fishing in the Arctic Ocean outside their 200-mile exclusive economic zones. In the United States, that area begins at the northern edge of Alaska. Fishing has already been banned within the American Arctic since 2009. Because this new moratorium applies to international waters in the Arctic Ocean, there's no guarantee that other countries will choose to honor it. The next step is to get more nations on board beyond these five Arctic states. In a statement, the Arctic group said they plan to spend the rest of the year lobbying for broader support. Kuskokwim fishermen are expected to face serious restrictions on subsistence salmon fishing this summer in efforts to bring more king salmon to the spawning grounds. With fishing closed possibly all of June, the working group is asking that dip nets be used selectively to harvest non-Chinook salmon. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
The season for king salmon is expected to be closed May 15th and stay closed through almost all of June. The preliminary fishing schedule may see some small changes, but the bottom line is that fishermen will see major restrictions. With that outlook, the Kuskokwim River Salmon Management Working Group wants fishermen to be able to get other species with dip nets. They've submitted an emergency petition to the Board of Fish. Dave Cannon works for the native village of Napaimute and is a working group member. He says the request comes as managers anticipate very few kings, somewhere between 70 and 117,000.
The run may be as low as we've ever seen it. There is a real good chance that there's going to be severe restrictions. What we all would like to see is some other opportunity for fishermen to go out there and harvest other fish other than king salmon.
With dip nets, any king salmon that were caught must be released back to the river alive. Dip nets are commonly used on the Kenai River. Last year, they were implemented on the Yukon River with some success.
The learning curve might be pretty steep at first. Find out where and how to actually use the net, but that's the hope, that people will be able to harvest sockeye and chums and be able to fill their needs as best as possible.
The board can consider the petition outside of its regular meetings and come back to the group with a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Another request submitted by the group seeks to limit the length of drift nets from 300 feet to 150 feet. That's a conservation method that would allow more kings to pass by.
We have talked with the troopers, and it is possible to be able to tie off, say, half of the net in the boat and only use basically half of the actual 300-foot net. There's not going to be any need to cut or damage the net.
Managers expect to get as close as they can to a final schedule in the first week of April in Anchorage. They will then attempt to get the word out about the extremely important year coming up.
We want to try and get as many fish within the escapement goal numbers up to the spawning grounds so that we do, in fact, have fish coming back you know, in the coming years and for future generations. We've seen the lowest run on record last year. Every single escapement project on the Kuskokwim was the lowest we've ever seen. So we are in pretty much a dire situation.
In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
For the past month, a group of fuel supply workers in Unalaska have been trying to unionize, and they've accused their employer, Delta Western, of mistreating them for it. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports the workers took to the picket line on Tuesday to protest.
Leo Dossio is a driver for Delta Western and a spokesman for the pro-union workers. He says the company cut off their access to some facilities after they walked off the job the first time in February.
They changed the locks on the break room and on the shop. And at the shop, that's where we wash our clothes, work clothes, and that's the only shower.
The only emergency shower to wash off chemicals in a hurry. The washing machines are there so employees don't have to worry about getting toxic or flammable substances in their machines at home. Dossio alleges that the only people who lost access to those facilities were the workers who wanted to join the Inland Boatmen's Union. He says they didn't get new keys again until Friday, and they only got them then because they asked their manager. Kirk Payne is the president of Delta Western.
They did have some issues with the lock. They changed it. This facility is open 7 in the morning, 7 p.m. every day, to where you don't need a key. And when somebody needed access to it or needed a key, they were given it.
In the last month, Payne and the president of Delta Western's parent company have both visited the island to talk with their employees. Brian Bogan is the head of North Star Petroleum, and he was in town just hours before Tuesday's strike. At this point, Delta Western workers say they're still waiting for the company to formally respond to a written request they made last month to be recognized as union members. Payne, the president of Delta Western, says that's not going to happen.
What the union needs to do is to file a petition with the NLRB that says, hey, these guys want to be represented.
The National Labor Relations Board would run the rest of the unionization process, possibly leading up to a formal vote. Adam Dalton is an organizer from the Inland Boatmen's Union. He's been in Unalaska for the past 2 weeks, and he says the workers are getting ready to file a petition with the NLRB sometime soon. In the meantime, Dalton says he's convinced that changing the locks at Delta Western did keep union supporters from accessing facilities. And Dalton says that that violates the National Labor Relations Act.
Basically, any change to the workers' conditions, their conditions of their employment that they had access to before, would be an unfair labor practices point since the guys have voiced their will to be union.
Dalton says the union is adding this alleged violation to a complaint they filed with the NLRB last month. That's when the Inland Boatmen's Union accused Delta Western of trying to intimidate and punish its pro-union workers. That kind of behavior is what the workers said they were responding to when they walked off the job on Tuesday. About a half a dozen Delta Western workers joined the picket line, despite the fact that the company fuel barge had just arrived to deliver a shipment. Delta Western rounded up a crew to unload the fuel, and they also called the police. Unalaska Police Sergeant Bill Sim says the picketers were technically trespassing as they stood at the mouth of Delta Western's fuel dock. The protesters moved, the police didn't get any more complaints, and the strike went on as planned.
Delta Western, you don't care!
Unsafe!
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 Unfair!
Delta Western has roughly 18 workers at its fuel shop in Unalaska. Right now, about 7 of them want to join the union. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering dental innovations from implants and Invisalign with 3 offices, 2 in Anchorage and 1 in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com. There's a good feeling you get when you give, and each year more Alaskans are supporting things they love when they file online for their PFD. Alaskans like you donated $2.5 million last year to strengthen education, help families in need of food and shelter, and protect the most vulnerable among us. You even shared your permanent fund dividends with public radio to keep quality programming alive and well. This year, the PFD is expected to be a lot bigger. So come on, love Alaska. Pick, click, give. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
The state has taken steps to ban the importation and sale of some aquatic plants that are commonly found in aquariums. Elodia is a plant used in fish bowls that has become a big problem in Alaska and is considered an invasive species. Last year, the state began working to eradicate the plant from areas in Fairbanks and in Anchorage. Breanne Blackburn is the state's invasive plant coordinator at the Plant Materials Center in Palmer.
The two that people are most familiar with that we collectively call Elodia here in Alaska, which are Elodia canadensis and Elodia natalii, have both been found within the last 5 years in Alaskan water bodies, and they are not native to the state.
The five aquatic plants now banned from Alaska are Canadian waterweed and Western Nutalii, Brazilian waterweed, hydrilia, and Eurasian water milfoil.
These species can reproduce very quickly, some of them by fragmentation, so they don't even need to produce seed, and can move very quickly on equipment that comes out of a water body or just by floating downstream and producing a new plant. They're a high risk for impacting our natural resources, and there's a very clear pathway into the state from the aquarium trade.
The State Division of Agriculture is in the process of amending current regulations to include the plants in the noxious weed listing. The quarantine prohibits the import, transport, buying, selling, or distribution of the plants in Alaska. The ban also prohibits the intentional transplant of wild plants of the species within Alaska. Elodia has been found in lakes near Anchorage and in Chena Slough in Fairbanks. Keegan Randall has a lock on her third straight World Cup sprint title. Randall did not make the finals in a classic technique sprint in Drammen, Norway, Wednesday, but her seventh place finish there mathematically clinches the season title. Just one sprint race remains. Retaining the title as the world's top woman sprinter is some consolation for Randall, who struggled at last month's Sochi Olympics, where she'd hoped to medal. Most speed records are broken by seconds or minutes. Yesterday, a Fairbanks cyclist demolished the Iditarod Trail Invitational record by almost a full week. KNOM's Anna Rose MacArthur has more from the finish in Nome.
After pedaling almost 1,000 miles from Kinnick Lake to Nome, Jeff Oatley rolled across the finish at 4:53 p.m. yesterday, totaling 10 days, 2 hours, and 53 minutes. The previous record was 17 days and 2 hours.
It's fun. I had a great time the whole time. There was not a lot of times when I was out there going, I wish I was at my desk doing work. I was having a blast.
This was Oatley's first race all the way to Nome, but Oatley is no rookie. He's completed the 350-mile route to McGrath 10 times. Only this year, he rode with a different goal in mind.
The mentality going in is, I'm going to get to Nome, no matter what. I'll get to Nome.
Oatley is not the only one who broke a record this year. So did Heather Best, Oatley's wife. Best completed the 350 miles to McGrath in 2 days, 13 hours, and 14 minutes, undercutting the shortest time in the women's division by over 27 hours. This year's shattering speeds are attributed to the lack of fresh snow. Dirt and ice, a lot of it glare ice, covered most of the trail, and the snow that did appear was mostly hard-packed. Oatley says the trail offered little reason to slow down or dismount, an option he welcomed when it came along.
I was not unhappy a few times when I had to get off to walk up hills and things like that. I didn't want any snow to slow me down because I was enjoying going fast, But when you never get off the bike, when you're just riding fast all the time, you get to a point where everything hurts from that, too. So it's nice to just change things up and get off the bike and walk.
But this toll, Oatley says, is only temporary.
It's a recreation, you know. It's and stress isn't necessarily a bad thing on the body or mental stress. It's just sort of a state you're in and you got to recover from.
Though racers who complete the Invitational to Nome travel almost 1,000 miles of Alaska's wilderness, winners receive no prizes, no money, no compensation. But Oatley says the race itself is its own purse.
Life is very simple when you're doing that kind of racing. You're just riding and eating and sleeping, and that's it. And it's got a very nice rhythm, and it's fun, and you're out and just awesome, incredible scenery. It's so stunningly beautiful, and it's just so hostile. I mean, the wind just seems like it's just eating at you from every direction all the time, and it's an experience. It's fun.
And as far as shattering records goes, well, Oatley remains unfazed.
I mean, people can say whatever they want. I mean, it's just a record. It'll get broken eventually.
16 competitors remain on the trail to Nome, 11 are on bikes, and 4 on foot. They come from 7 different countries. Reporting from Nome, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
In the sled dog version of the Iditarod, most mushers are still running with 14 or more dogs. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, mushers are surprised at how many dogs fared through the rough trail early on.
4-time champion Jeff King has towed a large trailer behind his sled since the start of the race. He carries one or two dogs in it at a time, while the rest of the team travels down the trail.
Using it both proactively for a dog I just, you know, important to later on in this race, and in the event I see one that has a little tick or lameness, first thing I do is give it a ride and then evaluate it so that if there is something there, it's not aggravated.
King's been resting his dogs en route for years. He says it saves energy for later in the race, and it takes some wear and tear off his equipment. Wear and tear is something this year's mushers know plenty about. They faced miles of rough and rugged snow-free trail early on. Canadian Michelle Phillips says she's definitely roughed up more than her dogs.
It seems that way. Yeah. Definitely.
Her legs are covered in huge purple bruises. Phillips pulls a little blue vial out of her pocket. It's medicine for both her and her dog team.
Homeopathic remedy, Arnica. I've gone through half a bottle, and anyone that's stiff or sore has taken it as well.
She's known for homemade remedies she uses to treat stiff and sore dogs.
It's a whole blend that I roll on, and then I make my own massage oil and foot ointment. That's got emu oil and a bunch of herbs and essential oils.
Hans Gott spent some of his 24-hour layover massaging and walking his dogs. He still has his full team. He says he's not letting anyone go until he has to.
I don't know. I mean, I'm not dropping anybody if they don't have to be dropped, that's for sure. It'd be a hoot to get to Nome at 16, but I know it's not going to happen.
Well over half the field still has dog teams numbering in the teens. Those with 15 and 16 dogs will have plenty of speed and power as they push forward toward the Yukon River. On the Iditarod Trail, I'm Emily Schwing.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing on the Iditarod Trail in Ruby, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Ben Matheson in Bethel, and Anna Rose MacArthur in Nome. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. If you're interested in serving on your local Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council, the deadline to apply is Friday, March 21st. Call 1-800-478-1456 for more information. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Support for APRN Iditarod coverage comes from Wells Fargo, proud supporter of the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the trail. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.